This is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture, with me, Neil Denny. Oldfield studied modern history at Oxford before becoming a writer and researcher on the BBC television show QI. She has worked on a string of best-selling QI books, writes the weekly QI column for the Daily Telegraph, and is a researcher on the Radio 4 show The Museum of Curiosity. She's also the author of The Secret Museum, which looks behind the scenes at the hidden treasures contained within the world's museums archives, and that's what we're going to be talking about tonight. So, Molly, thank you for being on Little Atoms.
And thank you so much for having me.
Let's first of all then talk about where did the idea for the book come from? When did you realise that the museums, I guess, were like an iceberg, that there's a little bit of a museum at the top and then a big warehouse behind it?
Yeah, it was actually one very specific day, and it was kind of an epiphany to me. At QI, we got an email from the fish curators at the Natural History Museum. They're called James and Ollie, and they said, we really love QI. Can we come and watch a live recording of the show? So we said, sure, but can we come and see what you do? So a couple of us who were interested to go trekked off to the Natural History Museum in South Kensington, and we met James and Ollie, and they took us behind the scenes to their fish realm, where they've got hundreds of thousands of fish stored in little glass bottles, The Spirit Collection, all dried in drawers, and that's where researchers from around the world can come and study any fish that they might like to study from the last 100 or so years from all different parts of the world. And we spent a couple of hours with them, and they showed us all kinds of things. They showed us specimens collected by Darwin on the Beagle. They showed us these sharks that Speedo had been working with to design really fast swim kit for the Olympics, which actually helped Michael Phelps to win Olympic gold. It's called Fast Skin, and it's kind of modelled on the shape of a shark's skin, and makes you obviously move really quickly through the water, and it's actually been banned because it gives you such an unfair advantage.
It was the fins, I think, probably.
Yeah, it's actually a shark's skin's really sharp. They're called denticles on the surface of the shark, and I think they like evolved into teeth. But anyway, they showed us that, and then what else did we see? A giant Archie the giant squid, who's quite famous. You can see him if you go on a behind-the-scenes tour. I was just basically, I realised that there was this whole world behind the scenes that I never knew existed. And I've been to a lot of museums over the years for QI research, and I thought, well, if I don't have any idea, then maybe a lot of people don't know this. And so I called a few other museums, like the Science Museum, said, have you got anything in storage? And they were like, quite a lot, you know. British Museum only displays 1% of the collection that they own. So I suddenly realised that this was a huge subject. And it kind of seemed like it hadn't really been written about before. Maybe certain museums have written a book about their treasures. Harvard Museum, for example, has the Natural History Museum there. But I thought I just was really interested. So I started to just travel around and going to different museums. It was really useful because it kind of overlapped with QI research as well. So anything that I didn't put in my book, I could put in a column or on the TV show. So it all worked quite nicely and symbiotically.
One of the things you saw on that first trip makes it into the book, doesn't it? So you talk about an anglerfish couple.
Oh, yes, the anglerfish couple. Yeah. They sort of, yeah, I suppose began the whole book, really. The specimen is in the Spirit Collection, so the anglerfish couple are quite interesting, basically, because the female is quite big, so say the size of a kind of large mango, and the male is absolutely tiny. You can barely see him. It's just quite clever evolution. The female, what happens is when the anglerfish male is born, he just senses out the female and then attaches to her backside, and he stays there for the rest of his life.
He's latched on.
He's just there living off of her in what I described as the world's worst boyfriend. And it's clever evolution because, of course, the male's there whenever he's needed, and they live in the deep sea, otherwise it might be quite hard for them to find each other.
Yeah, they probably
right
wouldn't
time.
Come across each other. Yeah,
exactly. So it's essential for the future of the anglerfish, but it was just, I found them interesting. They're an incredibly rare specimen. The museum had one other couple, but they dissected it to kind of find out more about them. It's very, very rare to find the female with male attached in a museum collection, which is why it's not on display, because if researchers want to come and have a look, it's easier if these things are not on show. because otherwise it would be a real hassle to have to take it out, put a little sign saying this isn't available. So the really useful specimens are all in the storage collection.
Now, we often have this idea that the fact that, say, for instance, the British Museum only has 1% of its collection on show is something to do with bad space management or just collectomania or something. They just can't stop collecting. But there's lots of reasons why they don't show things, not just because of lack of space.
Yeah, there are. I mean, with a natural history collection, say, take the fish, it's like a library of fish. Mm-hmm. So, as I said, researchers from everywhere can come and study. Say you're interested in a particular fish that lives in Congo, you'll be able to pull open drawers and find specimens from all different parts of a certain river over the last however many years. So it means that you don't have to go there, and it's just a very useful reference library. But in other museums, well, I think it is a question of space in a way, but it's also for study. Say the British Museum has a huge archive of hand axes over in Hoxton, and probably the best place in the world to go to study them. Mm-hmm. No one would, the general public wouldn't be interested to see that many hand axes.
Yeah, they might want to see one or two hand axes, but not hundreds. They need to see hand axe museum.
Thousands of them. Yeah, exactly. But again, this is just like drawers and drawers and drawers full of hand axes from all over the world, from all different periods of time. So, I mean, the number of drawers that I pulled open in that year and a half I was researching the book, mind-boggling.
Or there are things that are just too either valuable or too delicate to be on display as well.
A lot of things, yeah. I sort of realised how damaging the light is. So for colour and also particularly works on paper, they can't stand being out on the light for too much time. So a lot of very precious things need to be kept in the dark and only brought out very, very occasionally, if at all.
Well, people will be familiar with this anyway. Sometimes when you go to art museums, sure, there'll be darkened rooms where you can go and look at particularly like, you know, pencil and chalk drawings, as you say, are often in very, very dark, dingy little annexes and things.
Exactly. And sometimes I found a few things that were too big. So for the Science Museum is a good example of that. They've got a large object storage out in Wiltshire, which is an old RAF airbase. And they've got aircraft hangars filled with gigantic objects that would take up half of the museum in South Kensington. So that's where they all live, like huge Russian supercomputers and planes and helicopters and the machine that built the Channel Tunnel and the
first, that is big.
Yeah, pretty large. So yeah, that was a fun place to visit because you have to drive around. I drove around with the curator Peter in his Jeep with a hard hat on and like went in and out of aircraft hangars, and I picked the most unusual looking thing. There was just one thing that just looked so strange. I just wanted to know what it was, and it was a big white metal ball, and it turned out to be what is known as Picard's gondola. And so I found out the story of the whole Picard family, which I wrote about in the book. So essentially there was a man named Auguste Picard, and he created this white gondola, and he attached it to a hydrogen balloon, and he set off high up into the stratosphere, about 16 miles, I think, from where we're sitting now.
Roughly when was that?
It was quite a long time ago.
Yeah, so not recently, and when people were attempting to ascend very, very high. This is in the early age of ballooning.
Absolutely. He set the world record for the highest anyone had ever been above the Earth in this white ball. And then I think his whole family kind of had a passion for it. I think it was his sister used to make balloon ascents with her pet tortoise, who she called Fleur de Lis. And then later on, his son, Jacques Picard, adapted this balloon gondola and set a world record for the deepest down into the ocean anyone had ever been before. So he called the gondola the Trieste, and he went down into the bottom of the Mariana Trench.
So basically this family had everything covered, really, from the very lowest to the highest.
To the very highest. And also Auguste Picard's grandson is alive now, Bertrand Picard, and he is attempting to fly around the world powered only by solar energy. So I think he's he's managed flight, but he hasn't managed to circumnavigate the world yet, but he has done it in a balloon. So yeah, they're quite a cool family. That's what I like, really. There's just like going into the archives, I generally just turn up not really knowing what to expect and then just kind of follow whatever I found interesting, and I just ended up finding out all kinds of stories about things.
But this is going to be my next question again. How did you choose, basically? So you've just said that, you know, you would often just go to the museums and wander around and find an artifact. There must have been some things. Was there anything that you were aware of before that you knew somewhere had got or anything? Or did you choose particularly? How did you choose the museums as well?
I honestly, pretty much went wherever I had a friend who I could stay with.
Yeah, sure.
because of my budget, obviously. So I did a lot in London and mm-hmm. then just outside London. And then I went to New York and went to Boston and Washington from there. Went to Brazil. And where else did I go? I went to Sweden, France, a couple of other places mm-hmm. in Europe, Netherlands. I just picked places that I really wanted to go as well. Brazil, obviously.
it just happened to have a museum there.
Yeah. And sometimes I knew what they were going to show me. So, for example, I went to the Royal Society in London and I knew they had a piece of Newton's apple tree. Mm-hmm. And I specifically wanted to go and see that and to write about that. But when I got there, I found out much more than I expected to find out about it. And I also didn't realise how many things they had belonging to Newton. So they don't really have a museum there. They put a few things on display every now and again. But down in their basement, they have a huge collection, and they have lots of things belonging to Newton as well. They have a telescope. They have his early editions of all his manuscripts with, like, annotations by his friends, like Halley, for example, has mm-hmm. got comments in the margins of one of Newton's books. And they have his death mask, and they have some of his hair. And the thing I wrote about was a piece of the apple tree that he was sitting underneath when he had the idea for gravity. And I just found that really interesting because I, you know, everybody's heard the story, but I'd never quite conceived the actual, that there was really a tree that existed.
Oh, even
really
if it's true, because a lot of people think it's an apocryphal story as well, don't they?
Yeah, they do, but there's a text in the Royal Society where Newton's biographer, William Stukeley, tells mm-hmm. the story that Newton told him himself. So even if he kind of made it up as an excellent anecdote,
yeah, he still made it
came
up.
From him, yeah.
So when you say a piece of Newton's apple tree, I mean, are we talking about like a branch?
Yeah, pretty much. So the actual original tree fell over and they grafted it and there's a tree that grows in its place. Mm-hmm. But the original tree, when it died, the owner of Woolsthorpe Manor, which was the house in which Newton grew up and where the tree grew, he cut a few pieces out and gave them to the Royal Society. One's been sort of shaped into a prism and the others are just literally flat pieces of wood, kind of like a small ruler mm-hmm, or something. Mm-hmm. One is in a pink plastic bag, and that's because it was taken up to the International Space Station, and so they keep it in that bag. Now it's become part of the artifacts history.
Yeah, I mean, like you said in the book, it's a bag that's been into space. Yeah. I thought that's a bag that's worth something.
Yeah, exactly. And the curator told me that when they took that piece of apple tree up to the International Space Station, they also took a photograph from the collection of Newton. Mm-hmm. Well, like a postcard portrait. And they put it in the window of the space station so that he could look out. And they also took an apple with them, a real apple, which they wanted to drop in zero gravity to sort of show whether or not it floated or dropped to the ground. But they left it lying around somewhere in the space station and somebody got hungry and ate it. So they had to use a pear that they had instead because obviously they couldn't pop out to the shops. So that's what I quite like. You know, you find out funny little stories that otherwise, you know, would be lost.
What was the reaction of the museums when you contacted them to say, you know, because these are museums that have got these amazing collections on display to the public.
Yeah.
You know, they advertise, here, come to this museum and see this thing. So you're now going to ring them up and say, hello, I would like to come and visit your museum, but, you know, I want to poke around in the basement. So what did they tend to say?
They were all incredibly friendly and they generally said, okay. And so along I went. I'm trying to think if there were any that... I think I remember actually the Smithsonian. I went to their Air and Space Museum and they were a bit baffled. Mm-hmm. I got a call from this great guy, Brian, at the Smithsonian there, and he was like, Molly, you do know that all our most iconic objects are on display. And I was like, I know, but I'm still really interested. And then he said, I'll get back to you. And then he came back with a brilliant object, which is a spacesuit covered in moon dust mm-hmm. that's never, ever been on display because of this moon dust. And he told me that the other Apollo suits were dry cleaned when they came back to Earth. But this one never was, because it was from the last Apollo mission. They left it exactly as it was when it arrived back to Earth. And because of this moon dust, they haven't worked out a way to put it out in the main gallery of the Smithsonian without it degrading in mm-hmm. some way. So it's kept in a climate-controlled storage. So I went to see it, and there was this huge room, it's about half an hour outside of Washington, and it's filled entirely with spacesuits. And it's quite a bizarre room because the suits are each dressed on mannequins. they're headless, and they're all lying flat on bunk beds, five bunks high, mm-hmm. each one covered in a sheet. So you walk in, and it's a really bizarre sort of scene, sort of the place where spacesuits go to die. And yeah, we had loads of fun. They would just pull back a suit, and each one has the name tag on. So we saw Neil Armstrong's spacesuit, which was having conservation worked on mm-hmm. it. We saw his boots, which were covered in Velcro for inside the ship, so that he could stick himself to the side of the ship.
That's a really great detail. So yeah, so when I guess they're in zero gravity, so if they wanted to move around, they literally use Velcro.
Yeah, they had to stick themselves down onto the side so that they could talk to the camera back on Earth or something. Mm-hmm. Saw the overboots that stepped onto the moon, and then also this particular suit covered in moon dust that belonged to Harrison Schmitt. He was the only scientist who took part in the Apollo missions. Mm-hmm. And he spent all of his time on the moon, crawling around, collecting rocks, because he was a geologist. So his suit got really, really dirty, especially on the knees. Mm-hmm. So it was thickly coated with grey dust. And yeah, so I found that really cool. Getting as close to the moon as I possibly can.
And that was, it was Apollo 17, was it? So basically they were the last people to go as well. Yeah. So he's one of the last two men to have been on the moon, which is also quite a phenomenal thing to think.
Yeah.
Okay, well, we may as well start looking at the items in the book, and we'll start with the very first one, which is a Gutenberg Bible on vellum. But also I want to look at this one because it's in a particularly interesting museum, which I hadn't heard of before, the Morgan Library Museum in New York. So tell us about the museum, first of all.
So it's a very smart, lovely museum. It's quite near the New York Public Library. Mm-hmm. It's absolutely beautiful. It's made up of the collection of Pierpont Morgan, as in the bank.
Yeah.
And it's in his former home. And you can see his library, and you can sort of wander around in this beautiful place in which he lived. But he amassed so many fantastic things that there's never space to display all mm-hmm. of them. So all kinds of treasures are down mm-hmm. in the quiet vaults beneath the building, which I just found incredibly... It was one of the first museums that I visited, mm-hmm. and I was kind of blown away by it, actually, because it was so beautiful. And they've got all kinds of treasures. They've got Bob Dylan's notebooks. They've got scores by Mozart and Beethoven. They've got writings by Sylvia Plath. It's paintings, music, any kind of art he was interested to collect it, and also beautiful mm-hmm. jewellery, illuminated manuscripts. It was really hard to pick what to include, but I ended up writing about a Gutenberg Bible. They've got the most Gutenberg Bibles of any museum in the world, and the one that they pulled up from the vaults for me to look through was a Gutenberg Bible on vellum, and they just plunked it down on a table in front of me and gave me a piece of acid paper to turn the pages with, and then they just left me alone with it for the afternoon. And it was just great. I mean, it was one of the first things that I saw for my book, and mm-hmm. I suddenly just thought, oh, this is going to be a really great adventure, and I'm so lucky to be able to be seeing these things. And so, yeah, I couldn't really understand it, obviously. I just turned the pages and looked through it.
It's nicely illustrated.
It's very beautiful. Lovely colours and lots of gold. And yeah, it was there in August, so it's lovely and cold in the reading room. I remember that. but it's a beautiful museum. You should definitely go there.
I really like those sort of museums that, I guess, in the day and now, as you said, they've got some of Bob Dylan's papers, which is obviously a later acquisition, but those sort of museums that are based around just somebody who collected stuff. So, for instance, like one of my favourite places in London is the John Soane Museum, which is just like going into a crazy man's living room, basically, and it's just all like completely eclectic stuff all over the place.
Yeah.
And there's museums that have that sort of collection rather than, say, this is a science museum, this is a natural history museum. They're just great places just to go in and wander around and never know what you're going to come across.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. Absolutely.
So Gutenberg was, I mean, he basically invented the printing press.
Yeah.
Okay, so this was the first mass-produced, if that's the right word, book. How many of the Bibles are there left?
Well, in the world, there are 50 or so copies in existence. Only 12 of those are on vellum. Mm-hmm. The Morgan owns 3 copies in total, which is more than any other institution in the world. Mm-hmm. And I had an afternoon to myself with the Morgan's copy of the Bible on vellum.
Mm-hmm. And vellum is?
It's animal skin.
So does that mean, are all the pages animal skin?
Yeah, in that particular book. So they were more expensive than the copies on paper, and they're rarer.
Mm-hmm.
So they brought that one up for me to see, because
beyond, obviously, I can imagine the cover of the book being sort of a leather book.
Yeah, big.
What's it like when, because how thick are the pages?
They're not that thick.
Yeah.
It's like very thick paper, mm-hmm. but it's not like, a rug or something like that.
Yeah, that would be a thick ball.
Yeah, it'd be gigantic.
This is Little Atoms. I'm Neil Denny, and this week I'm talking to Molly Oldfield about her book, The Secret Museum. Molly, in this second part of the show, then, let's just spend some time going through a random selection of the artefacts. We looked at a couple in the first half, but we'll go into some detail in this part. And I've chosen just a random selection, as I said. Some things that are, you know, incredibly valuable in terms of money, and things encrusted in jewels and gold and things like that. Some things that are sentimental value rather than amazing and interesting objects, but not necessarily of huge monetary value. And some things as well that are just... I chose literally because of the enigmatic titles that you gave them in the book, really. Things that draw you in because you sort of think, what on earth is this? Is this thing? Well, we'll get to some of those and on. But also, the other thing I was going to say was that sometimes I'd like to talk about things that are, because of the museum, because of the place that they're based in, which has some sort of interest as well as a particular object. And this is a good example of that. So the object is, or there are three pieces of Mars. But the reason I want to talk about these is because of where they are. They're Vatican Observatory, which is Castel Gandolfo, which is one of the Pope's holiday homes outside of Rome.
Home.
And the observatory is not a public museum, is it?
No.
It's not. This is one of the places in the book that you go to that's not somewhere that people can go and see the objects that they do have on display. So tell us about the observatory first.
So it's in Castel Gandolfo, as you said, which is just outside of Rome. So I took the train out from Rome, and I was met by the curator of the observatory, who is a Jesuit monk called Brother Guy Consolmayr. It's always a Jesuit monk who runs the collection. He's been there for quite a while, and he's an absolutely lovely guy. So we walked up through the town and then into a big square, and then we were buzzed through into the museum itself. I didn't see the actual observatory because that was quite a while. You have to walk from the museum across a whole bunch of orchards.
Yeah, it's still on the same grounds.
Yeah, exactly, but it was quite far from the museum.
And it used to actually be in the Vatican, didn't it?
So originally, the Pope's observatory was in the Vatican, but in 1935, it moved out of the city into Albano because of light pollution. And actually, since 1935, light pollution has spread further out to where it is now. So what I found out was that the Vatican also has another observatory, which is in Arizona. So Brother Guy spends his time between Arizona and Albano. And he told me that they've got a state-of-the-art telescope out in Arizona, which was built by a man called Roger Angel. So he likes that a lot, that the Pope's telescope was made by an angel.
So I mentioned that we're going to be talking about three pieces of Mars.
Yeah.
Now, obviously, well, we've been to Mars... Or
have
at
you?
Least robots have, not me personally, but you know, we've sent things to Mars, but we haven't come back.
Yeah.
So how have we got three pieces of it?
Because they fell to Earth.
Mm-hmm.
In this museum, it's full of meteorites, but I just chose the pieces of Mars because I thought they were the most interesting.
Mm-hmm.
How do we know they're from Mars?
Yes, that's a good question.
Well, I did ask him that, and he says... The long explanation is because other meteorites contain metals and Mars rocks don't. Secondly, they've tested these and they're a billion years old, which is young compared to the other meteorites in the collection. And thirdly, there are bubbles of gas trapped inside them that have been tested using a mass spectrometer. It turns out that these meteorites exactly match the atmosphere of Mars as recorded by the Mars rover.
So we've got meteorites that have appeared on Earth,
yeah.
And then subsequently we've gone to Mars with a rover and have been able to test the atmosphere.
Yeah,
and been able to make that.
They match.
Mm-hmm.
So, but they're from different bits of the planet, so they look a bit different. It's quite interesting, isn't it? It's kind of like from here imagine Mars to be just like the same everywhere, but Earth, which is completely different all over the planet. The Vatican also has a thing that I really like, which is a globe of Mars. So, like, obviously, we're very used to globes of Earth, but I hadn't seen one of Mars before. I thought that was quite nice. It was a gift from NASA to the Vatican.
The next object I want to look at, as I said, I mentioned earlier that some of the ones sound quite enigmatic, and this was the first one. It really leapt out at me. You describe it as things beneath the floorboards.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, this is at the Museum of the History of Science in Oxford, another museum that I wasn't actually aware existed until I read this in the book. But what have they got beneath their floorboards that's so interesting?
Well, essentially, this is more a story of the first museum in England than it is the story of the Museum of the History of Science. So there were two gardeners, both called John Tradescant, father and son, and they worked for the royal family, and they were gardeners at the time when the New World was first discovered.
Mm-hmm.
So they went out over to Virginia, to the early colonies, and they collected plants to bring back to grow here in England. That was their job. But on the side, they collected interesting artifacts. When I was studying at Oxford, I remember going into the Ashmolean and seeing this incredible coat that was covered in seashells, and it belonged to the king of the native Indians who were living in Virginia when John Smith and the whole English crew arrived. His name is Powhatan, and this was his incredible coat. His daughter was Pocahontas, who married John Smith, who was the head of the settlers. It was my favourite thing that I saw in the Ashmolean, and I really remembered it, which is, I think, why I became interested in this particular story. So that coat was collected by John Tradescant, senior, I think, but I'm not entirely sure. So the Tradescants collected this massive collection of interesting artifacts, such as Powhatan's mantle, all kinds of things that were treasures of the New World that had never been seen before over here. And they put them on display in their house, which was in Lambeth. And so many people were interested to see their treasures that they started to charge people to come over. And they called their home the Ark, and people would come round and give them a bit of cash and poke around their house and see all these interesting things. And that became the world's first museum. Now, when they died, the collection was bought by a man called Elias Ashmole, who then opened a museum with it in Oxford and called it the Ashmolean, which was a bit sneaky, really. That became the Ashmolean, which has moved location now. It's in a really beautiful building near Worcester College. But in those early days, it was next to the King's Arms pub, if any of you know Oxford quite well. It's now the Museum of the History of Science. But when the museum was doing renovations, they lifted up the floorboards and they found lots of tiny little ephemeral treasures from the early days of the museum when it was the working Ashmolean. And so it was just tiny little things, but precious because they're so unique and tell a tale of everyday life in this very first museum.
How had they got there?
They'd literally fallen beneath the floorboards. And so they'd stayed there until recently. They were renovating the building and lifted it up. So it was tiny things, like leftovers from things that people have been eating, like cherry stalks or shells of nuts. There are also little paper cuts and like rude notes, like telling jokes about like head curator. And the reason that I liked it was because it just gave you a flavour of that early museum.
Yeah, absolutely.
And since it's a book about museums, I thought it was kind of an interesting way to tell the story of how they came about.
Absolutely. So give us a rundown of some of the things that they actually
pulled. Some of the things that they pulled out of the dust include a label from a key that belonged to a man called Dr. Plot, who was the keeper of the museum. They found labels from portraits. They found a dried up lizard, a book cover, some flowers, an unopened letter, which they still haven't opened, but I definitely would have opened. There was a little paper cut of a house. And there was a sketch of a man called Edward, who was a keeper at the museum, with a little flower drawn underneath him. There was a ring, a penknife, a little child's tooth with a hole drilled through, which they think might have been worn around somebody's neck. And wax seals, coins. They're all just tiny treasures that must have fallen out of someone's pocket, dropped off a table, and just survived by chance.
Moving on to the next item then, and this is completely the opposite end of the scale, something that is, you know, jewel encrusted and incredibly precious. This is a bejeweled cross, which is in the museum that you alluded to in the first half in Brazil, which is the Museu de Arte Sacra in Salvador de Bahia, which I've probably slaughtered in pronunciation in both of those things. So, well, first of all, what is this? What is this object?
It's a large processional cross that's completely covered in emeralds and rubies and all kinds of precious stones. And it was similarly kept under the floorboards, but on purpose. So the Museum of Sacred Art in Salvador is in a former monastery, And when Brazil was a colony, it was full of Portuguese monks. Mm-hmm. They lived there. They would have used this cross for ceremonies. But when they left Brazil, the monks hid it underneath the floorboards. And it stayed there, again, for several centuries.
Until, just undiscovered?
Undiscovered, yeah.
Oh, wow.
Until the monastery was redeveloped and turned into the Sacred Art Museum. But the cross isn't put on display because it's incredibly valuable and incredibly precious. And unfortunately, the Sacred Art Museum is now in quite a dodgy area of Salvador. And so the curator won't put it out on show because he doesn't want people turning up with guns and robbing his museum. So he didn't even show me where it's kept. I sat in his office and he asked his assistant to go and get it. And she came into the office with it covered in a cloth. And then he sort of like almost pulled the blinds to show it to me. He wouldn't tell me where it was kept and probably best that I don't know. But yeah, it was probably the most valuable thing that they own. But unfortunately, mm-hmm. they can never display it.
So what did it look like?
Like a quite a tall cross covered in jewels. And there's a circle in the middle where they keep the communion wafers.
Mm-hmm.
So it was used during communion. They'd open this little circle. And
so it's basically like an incredibly expensive biscuit tin.
Kind of, yeah.
What was this museum like to visit then? Because you just mentioned that it's in, you know, a rather less salubrious area.
It was a beautiful museum, really, really beautiful. I went there in a cab though, and the driver said, when I got off the car, he said it showed me where it was. He didn't drive right down to it, he sort of pointed down the road to where it was. And then he said to me, make sure when you come out that you run back up to this main road and get a taxi. Don't hang around. I was like, okay.
Like as if a person running up the road is not going to attract more attention.
Yeah. But I was fine, you know. I'm still here.
The next one, let's move on to the next artefact, which I chose this one because it's got, again, it's got quite an enigmatic name.
Oh, yes.
But then you can describe what it actually is. The artifact is called Tablet K143.
Oh, yeah. So this actually was one of my favourite trips in the book because of the curator, whose name is Irving Finkel.
Mm-hmm.
He's a really, really lovely guy and super interesting. And that's kind of part of my book as well. Like, it's not only telling you about interesting things that are behind the scenes in museums. I also try to give a flavour of the people who look after them and kind of preserve our mm-hmm. world's heritage. And there's some really interesting characters and people with incredible knowledge, incredibly niche knowledge as well. And so Irving Finkel is one of the world experts on cuneiform, which is the world's first written script. And his realm is this place called the Arched Room, which is in the British Museum behind the scenes. So if you go into the ancient Assyrian room of the British Museum, I think it's room 9, Irving Finkel is behind that room. And he showed me around the library of a man called King Ashurbanipal, who lived in ancient Assyria. And he, Finkel described him as the last Arabian Nights king.
Mm-hmm.
And he absolutely loved literature. And he devoted years to creating this incredible library. So he'd send agents all around his kingdom and also to their enemy kingdom, which was Babylonia, to collect all kinds of stories, myths, spells, and also boring things like accounts and like tax things. And he had 12 scribes in a room copying everything into what Finkel called perfect BBC English. So basically they copied everything into perfect cuneiform script, and then it was put in the library. So everything in the library looked the same. And that's where we get the Epic of Gilgamesh. It's probably the most famous thing to have come from this library. It was sort of passed down to us from here. And everything was written on clay tablets using a reed. So you'd have a wet piece of clay, and the scribe would take a reed with a blunt end and press the shape into the tablets and then bake it in the sun and then put it in the library. And yes, so you've got everything in the same script, apart from one particular clay tablet, which is the piece that I wrote about, which has got really big, slightly babyish cuneiform scripts on it. And they think that this was the exercise book of the king who created the library.
Mm-hmm.
So when he was learning to write, they think that he probably wrote this himself when he was about 8 or 9. So it's the equivalent of a school exercise book for us. Like, you might in your attic have something that you wrote when mm-hmm. you were a kid at school. It's exactly the same thing.
But it's the same language, but it's just not as neat, not as uniform
exactly.
as the other things, yeah.
The script is much bigger and it's just not so perfectly written. So why would it be in this library?
Yes.
Unless it was something sentimental to the king? So I like that because it kind of showed that common humanity, like, just as I've got stuff from when I was at school that I mm-hmm. like, so did this king of Assyria. I thought it was really great. And also I like the story of the library because it was set on fire by the Babylonians during the king's reign, so mm-hmm. he must have been devastated. But in the long run, it was a useful thing because the fire properly baked all of the clay tablets so that they turned into a kind of terracotta mm-hmm. and they survived intact inside the earth until 19th century archaeologists dug it all up and they brought it to the British Museum. And Irving Finkel has been working there since 1979, piecing together the stories and myths and spells mm-hmm. that have been shattered into pieces. He's slowly putting them back together and he calls it a giant cosmic jigsaw. And he says, you know, that moment where you put the last piece of a spell back together again is a very magical moment.
Well, that's over 30 years that yeah. one person has been, Irving Finkel has been working there,
yeah.
but they have such a, there's so much of this stuff, isn't it? They've even then, in 30 years, they've barely sort of barely
yeah.
scratched the surface.
They
of the
need help.
Of aspects,
Not
yeah.
many people speak cuneiform, so or can read it. So yes, they definitely.
What's he doing to pass
recruits.
It on? Is he?
I'm not sure if his children are doing it, but he's definitely got students.
I'm going to something from the sublime to the ridiculous, shall I say, the next one I'd like to look at. Yes. This is, no, I'll say this as straight as I can, Nabokov's Butterfly Genitalia Cabinet.
Yep, exactly. This is Vladimir Nabokov, the writer, who wrote Lolita most famously and heaps of brilliant work. He sort of had two twin passions running throughout his life. One was writing novels and the other one was butterfly collecting and curating. And when he left Europe and moved to America, his first job there was the curator of butterflies at Harvard University. Mm-hmm. And that's where this cabinet lives. In his former office, which is still the current butterfly curator's office. And it's a wooden cabinet, and inside are cardboard boxes filled with glass vials, and inside each glass vial is one tiny dried up butterfly penis. And they explained to me that he wasn't perverted, or maybe he was, but he wasn't weird to do this because that is what butterfly curators do. Mm-hmm. It's the best way to tell one species of butterfly apart from another, mm-hmm. which is kind of interesting because you'd think butterflies look so different.
Yeah.
But in fact, no, this is the way that it's done. And it was realised because alongside each of all the specimens, there are index cards. And he's written notes and catalogued the specimens. But he also wrote his novels on these index cards. Mm-hmm. So Lolita was written on index cards like that. He'd go out to the countryside at the weekend with his wife and collect butterflies in nets during the day and then preserve the specimens. And then at night, he'd write his novels on the same cards and his wife would type them up. So he kind of merged his two passions quite well, I think.
How many butterfly penises did you see? How many was there
in the cabinet?
Yeah, roughly.
A couple of hundred, maybe? Mm-hmm.
So quite a lot.
Yeah, quite a lot.
That's quite a lot. A lot of butterfly penises.
Yeah, all in one place.
And did they have, I mean, he was, as you said, he was a, you know, a famous lepidopterist.
Yes.
Do they have in the same museum? I mean, does any more of his collection survive? Is there lots and lots of
There's not a lot there, but there are a few that he collected, yeah. And they showed me some quite cool butterflies. There was one that I really liked. It was a huge butterfly, not collected by him, collected by someone else in Papua New Guinea, and it had a note on it saying, "This collector was eaten by cannibals." So it showed you the lengths to which people go to.
Yeah, well, luckily the butterfly survived the man's tragic end.
Yeah.
Let's just talk about one more item then, Molly, in this section. And this one, as I said, we talked about a bejeweled cross, which was, you know, possibly one of the most valuable things you saw on the trip. This is a thing of an entirely different type of value. And I'm talking about something called a heart token, which is in the Foundling Museum in London. So, well, tell us about this, the museum, first of all. So the Foundling Museum is what?
Foundling Museum is in the same building as the former Foundling Hospital, mm-hmm. which was set up to take in babies whose mothers couldn't take care of them for one reason or another. England was quite behind, actually. Like, most places in Europe had foundling hospitals before London did. But when it opened, it was very oversubscribed, and mothers would come and bring their children who they couldn't, well, babies who they couldn't look after. And they would have to enter a lottery system. A mother had to draw, they were taken into a room and asked to put their hand into a bag filled with different coloured balls. If they pulled out a white one, then their baby would become a foundling and would be taken in by the hospital and cared for. And if the ball was black, then the mother would have to take the baby home and try to find some way else to take for the child to be taken care of. Now, when mothers left their babies, they were asked to leave a token so that if they could ever return to collect them, mm-hmm. there would be a way to identify them. So it could be like a little pendant but very often it was a piece of clothing. So what they would do actually is, if a mother didn't have anything to leave as a token, what they would do was cut a piece of fabric out of the dress that she was wearing that day or out of the clothes that the baby was dressed in. Then the mother would keep a piece and a piece would be kept to the hospital. Then if the mother could ever go back, they would bring that piece of fabric with them and match it up to the piece of fabric kept at the hospital, and mm-hmm. then she'd be able to reclaim her child. So the pieces of fabric are now kept in huge leather-bound books. Each one says the name of the child and has the piece of fabric sort of pinned onto the page. And they were kept at the hospital. And then when it was closed and turned into the museum, they were transported to the London Metropolitan Archives, which is where I went to see them.
Mm-hmm.
So really, really quite emotional, actually.
Yeah, I mean, it must be incredibly heart-rending to see these things.
It's so sad, and often there's little notes left of the child. Like, the children were usually renamed when they became foundlings. So often the mothers would say, please can you call it Anne? But that didn't really happen. Or they would say, this child will definitely be called for again. Like, mm-hmm. sort of, you know, it was very desperate and very sad stories. And you know that normally they weren't called for. But the piece that I chose was the kind of happy story in amongst them all,
mm-hmm.
which is it's a token created by a lady who we know was called Sarah Bender, and her son was called Charles. And what she did was she stitched together about 8 different pieces of fabric, and then across them she stitched a red heart, and she cut it in 2, and she kept half of the heart for herself, and half of the heart was pinned mm-hmm. onto this sort of certificate with her son. When he became a foundling, he was renamed Benjamin Twell. And he lived there at the hospital for quite a few years, 8 years in fact, until she was able to return with her half of the heart and match it up to his and take him home with her. So we hope that that was a happy ending.
Yeah, a good one that had a happy ending. You're listening to Little Atoms. I'm Neil Denny, and I'm talking to Molly Oldfield about her book, The Secret Museum. And Molly, we'll carry on looking at some of the artefacts in your book, just a few more.
Okay.
Here's a good example of one that is not on display because of, well, size. The basic answer to this. So this is a flag from the Battle of Trafalgar that is owned by the National Maritime Museum in Greenwich.
Yes.
So tell us about this flag and its provenance.
So it was flown at the Battle of Trafalgar. It's an ensign flag.
And it was literally flown.
During the battle. So it was from a Spanish warship called the San Ildefonso. So it flew off the back of that ship so that everybody knew the name of that of the boat.
Yeah.
So that's what the ensign flags, they're kind of like the mm-hmm. the name tag.
Yeah.
Essentially. They're huge so that you can see them from miles away. It was captured at the Battle of Trafalgar, and when Nelson obviously died towards the end of the battle, the flag, along with the French flag, ensign flag, was taken back to England, and it hung from the roof of St. Paul's Cathedral during Nelson's funeral. So the French flag and the Spanish flag mm-hmm. were both flown to symbolise the great victory that Nelson had won with his life. And then the flag hung around St. Paul's, no one really taking care of it for a while, and it unfortunately got eaten by quite a lot of moths. And now it belongs to the National Maritime Museum, mm-hmm. who carefully look after it. It's wrapped up in tissue paper and stored in a huge cardboard box, but they can't display it because it's just simply too big to hang from any of the walls inside the museum.
Mm-hmm.
It would trail all over the floor. They've gone out twice since they've owned it. Once in the 1960s, they hung it just for fun off the front of the museum building, but it trailed around in the mud.
So even then it was too big to be hung off, which is, the Greenwich Maritime Museum is not insubstantial building.
Exactly. It's pretty huge, isn't it? And it trailed in the mud. They said, they could never get away with that now.
Yeah.
And then more recently, they took it out simply to photograph it so that they can put a picture of it on their website so people would know that it exists. They were actually quite excited about this, hoping it would be quite a big day for the museum. And they invited lots of press along to take pictures of it. But it was the day that Prince Charles announced his engagement to Camilla Parker Bowles. So apparently all the press just, ran off. But, to take a photograph of it, they had to hire a cherry picker. And the photographer had to be standing in that, looking down on the flag, snapping away at it. And I've got a photograph of it in my book. And across the top of it, there's about 8 curators. And they look like little ants because the flag really is so big. And also in the photo, you can see that it's got lots of holes in it. And these were actually from the battle, cannonballs shooting through the flag and tearing it. It's quite epic. And I got to touch it. It's quite dirty and it's very coarse. It's made out of wool, so it's quite itchy. But it lives in this cardboard box, unfortunately. It's 10 metres long and 14.5 metres high, and it's the biggest flag in the collection. So it's going to stay in the archives because it's too big.
Yeah, this is one that's not likely to be on display that often in the future.
No.
Especially now they've got a photograph of it.
Yeah.
Okay, the next one then, another one of these ones with a rather enigmatic title, and it's rather an amazing story behind this artefact. And the artefact is just called Song 21. It's found in the Canadian Museum of Civilization in Ottawa, and the number suggests that it's one of a number of songs. So tell us what it is.
So Song 21 is one of 137 songs which was collected by an ethnologist called Diamond Jeunesse. He went out to the Canadian Arctic in 1913 and he lived with an Inuit family for 2 years to learn all about them. And he wrote an amazing book, which I read, called The People of the Twilight. He really became part of the family, so you learn all about the really happy young girl in the family. They called Jenny Sunshine.
Which is the greatest name.
So sweet, isn't it? And the mother was called Ice House, and the father, Ick Puck, and the brother was called The Runner. And you really, learn to love the characters and the people in the family. And, and they also came to quite love him, although they found him very unusual, obviously, when he first arrived. Especially, he took with him an Edison phonograph, which he used to record their speaking and their songs. So this, I could have chosen any of the songs in the collection of songs that he recorded, really. Mm-hmm. But I chose Song 21 because it's the only one for which they have a photograph of the man who sung it. He was called Angivanra, and there's this beautiful picture of him with his instrument drumming in a place called Barron's Island in 1915. And I've listened to the song.
Yeah, so obviously. I was going to say, what does it actually sound like?
He's sort of going, and drumming. And it's like, the reason it is amazing is because this song will never ever be sung again. Because even during Diamond Jeunesse's lifetime, the way that the tribe lived was completely, their way of life was destroyed. These people came into their land to hunt for furs, and they brought with them diseases. So, in fact, I think Jenny Sunshine died. A lot of the people who Diamond Jeunesse came to know died during his lifetime. So it's really, really sad. But it is also wonderful that we have a kind of trace of their existence recorded in these songs. They're all on wax cylinders and they're all in the archives because there's no way you can really display that kind of thing. Yeah. It's kind of like intangible heritage, but they are, all the recordings are there.
And I guess this, what's great about these is it is something that they can take recordings of, so people can hear it, the music, without necessarily having to play a wax cylinder of the music. Okay, well, I just want to look at one more before we finish. Unfortunately, as it's going to turn out, this one's quite similar in some respects to the one we've just talked about. This is a friendship book, which you can tell us what that is, but it's basically kept in the archive of the Anne Frank House in Amsterdam, which will tell listeners pretty much all you need to know about about this book.
Yeah.
So what is a friendship book?
So the curators, Erica Prince, who's the curator at the Anne Frank House Museum, she told me that in Amsterdam it used to be traditional for girls to give each other friendship books, and they'd write poems and messages to each other, which they could then keep. And so, of course, Anne Frank was just like other girls of her age. So when she was about 11 years old, her friends and her at school exchanged friendship books. And this particular book that I've written about in the Secret Museum belonged to Anne Frank's friend Jultje. So the friendship book was a gift from Kitty, a girl in their class called Kitty, to Jultje. But Anne Frank wrote inside it, mm-hmm. as of course everyone in her class would have done. So I was handed the book, which they handed it to me on a pillow, laid open at the particular page of the book where Anne Frank had written her message. So she'd stuck a little photograph of herself on the left-hand spread of the double page, and on the right she'd written a really sweet poem, which I could read to you. She wrote, "Dear Jultje, what shall I write here? Wait, dear Yul, I have an idea. Good health and all the best. Be good and full of zest, and whatever fate may be divining, remember, every cloud has a silver lining. In memory of your friend, Anne Frank." And then really sweetly, in the corners around her photo of the page around her photograph, she's written, "Forget me not." So, now,
despite that, every cloud has a silver lining, obviously we know what happened to Anne. What happened to Jultje, and how did the book end up in the collection of the Anne Frank Museum?
Well, unfortunately, Jultje had a very sort of sad ending herself. She didn't know that Anne Frank had moved into the annex above Otto Frank's office by the canal. She thought that Anne Frank and all her family had escaped to Switzerland. Really sadly, a year after Anne Frank went into hiding, a friend of Jultje's family, who was a girl called Lineke van der Waal, she was riding her bike one Sunday morning just outside of Amsterdam, and she came to a roadblock and saw that there was about to be a raid on Jewish homes. So she quickly cycled back to warn her friends, and Jultje gave Lineke this friendship book, which they call them poesy albums. She gave it to her for safekeeping, which is how the book survived. Unfortunately, Jultje did not. Her and her family were taken from their home that day, and they were killed 3 weeks later in Poland. So she didn't survive, but the friendship book did. And so did Kitty, the girl who had given the friendship book to Jultje at her birthday party for her 11th birthday. That was before the war began. Years later, Kitty gave it to the Anne Frank House, and they've never ever displayed it or really showed it to mm-hmm. anyone. And when I turned up at the museum, I sort of told them what I was doing, and they were really sensitive about it, and they weren't really sure, you know, that they had anything or that how it would be handled. So I sort of talked to them for quite a while before they ended up showing me this beautiful, amazing, mm-hmm. it was so moving and like a real privilege to be shown it. And then I had quite a bit of back and forth with them, sort of sending them what I'd written and then adapting it and changing it. Not changing it, but, you know, just making sure I had everything right. And now they're really, really pleased actually to have shown this piece and like for people to know its story, and they've put it on their blog and on their website quite a lot, and it's quite nice that it's out there. And in fact, they've asked me if I wanted to meet Kitty's aunt, I think it is, who lives in Edgware.
Oh wow.
So I might meet her at some point.
That would be amazing.
Yeah, which would be kind of amazing.
I do think this is perhaps a rather profound and sad one for us to finish up on. So is there any that we haven't covered that are particularly favourites of yours, and perhaps one that's a it doesn't end in a tragic death.
Well, one that I quite like, but is quite sort of gruesome, is Charles Dickens's letter opener.
That's a great one. Yeah, tell us very quickly about that.
So Charles Dickens had a pet cat called Bob, and when it died, he was so sad that his sister-in-law had the paw of Bob made into a letter opener, which Charles Dickens used every day to open his letters at Gad's Hill, which is just really quite bizarre. And that lives in the New York Public Library. Mm-hmm. It's not on public display. It's in a special reading room called the Berg Reading Room, which you can only go to study works by Dickens and by Thackeray, because the Berg Reading Room was founded by two brothers, and one brother loved Dickens, one loved Thackeray. So if you're interested in those two authors, you can go there by special permission and read about them and see their artifacts and collections. Oh, I also really like the two hats that Livingstone and Stanley were wearing.
I thought you might mention that one.
When they met in Africa. So they're the hats that they doffed to one another when Stanley did or didn't say Dr. Livingstone, I presume. And they're side by side in the archives of the Royal Geographical Society, which is a place I really like. So,
and anybody listening to Museum of Curiosity this very week would have heard about the compass.
Oh, yes.
John Blatchford Snell had the compass.
Okay,
that's much more light-hearted, nicer place for us to finish on this. Just a couple more things before we do finally finish. So you mentioned that the choice of the museums to go to was sort of predicated on, you know, the availability of a bed to crash on and things in terms of budget. Can you think of any that you would have liked to have gone? Is there some things that you would like to have covered that, you know, for time or budget couldn't be included?
Well, when I was in the stage of sort of researching and writing, I almost went to Japan and Korea. Mm-hmm. I would love to have gone to Asia and also Australasia, because I obviously didn't go anywhere east.
Yeah.
And I would love to have done. But I kind of ran out of time.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe another book.
Yeah, well, this is what we're getting onto next. So what's next? Because what's great about this book is, you know, there's a whole world of museums out there.
Yeah.
This could be the first volume of a long string of secret museum books. Do you have plans to do more?
Of more about museums?
Yes, I mean, do you have plans to do another volume?
No, not at the moment, but I could.
But it's feasible.
Yeah, for sure.
And there's other things. You know, I was reminded again reading it of it's sort of a different take on the I can't remember what it's called, that Radio 4 series that was
History of the World in 100 Objects.
Exactly, that sort of thing. You know, I could picture it as a radio show or a TV series of a similar thing.
Well, yeah, I've been approached by a few different TV production companies, sort of still trying to work out the best way forwards with it, mm-hmm. really. Because I think, they're incredibly visual, these archives, and all different. And obviously there's countless stories to tell. I mean, I picked 60, which I think you could tell in much greater detail visually, but you could also pick any number of others. So.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, that's a perfect point for us to end. So I've been talking to Molly Oldfield, and we've been talking about her book, The Secret Museum. It's out from Collins, is the publisher, I believe, is it? Okay, so Molly, thank you very much for coming in and talking to me today.
Thank you so much.
I'm John Rogers. You've been listening to Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture. This episode of Little Atoms was produced and presented by Neil Denny and was broadcast on Resonance 104.4 FM. You can find the Little Atoms podcast on iTunes, and you can follow the show on Twitter at Little Atoms. If you'd like to donate a little money to support the show, you can do so at littleatoms.com. Thanks for listening.